Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Tanisha, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect workshop, Advances in the Treatment of Oral and Head and Neck Cancer. It's a very important workshop, and actually it's a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call today over 869 participants, so you're a very large group of people on the call today. And you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, China, and the United Kingdom. So it's a bit of a global call as well. This program is made possible by a charitable contribution from Bristol-Myers Squibb and Imclome Systems, a wholly owned subsidiary of Eli Lilly and Company. And we really want to thank them for their support of the program today. I would like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about all the different collaborating organizations, about our speakers and the topics that will be covered, and there also is an evaluation form. I would ask you to take a moment at the end of the program today and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the topics you'd like us to offer? Indeed, the topic today was one that many of you have recommended, and we try very hard to really follow your recommendations. This is we're planning many programs in 2012, and so this is a very good time for you to tell us what you'd like us to offer. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker, Dr. Anne Gillenwater. Dr. Gillenwater is professor, Department of Head and Neck Surgery, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Gillenwater is going to address an overview of oral and head and neck cancer, staging and diagnosing, and plastic and reconstructive surgery. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Gillenwater.
I would like to thank Cancer Care and for giving me the opportunity to talk with you today. I think this is a very important forum to provide education for patients and other interested parties. I'm going to talk a little bit today with an overview of head and neck cancer, and I'll go a little bit over diagnosis and staging, and just barely touch on the different types of treatments, resections and reconstructions that we do for different head and neck cancers. Now, officially, the term head and neck cancer refers to those malignant tumors arising in the anatomic region of the head and neck, and these include oral, pharyngeal, and laryngeal cancers, as well as tumors arising in the nose and sinuses, nasopharynx, salivary glands, and skin. Usually, however, when people use the term head and neck cancer, they use it to describe the more common squamous cell carcinomas that arise from the lining of the upper aerodigestive tract. That includes the mouth, the throat, or pharynx, and the voice, or larynx. Today, we will focus our discussion on these head and neck squamous cell carcinomas. Now, currently, head and neck cancer accounts for about 3-5% of all cancers in the United States. This amounts to approximately 52,000 patients that are diagnosed each year. But worldwide, head and neck cancer, particularly squamous cell carcinomas of the oral cavity or mouth, is a very serious health problem and global health issue, and it ranks as one of the top 10 cancers. It is particularly prevalent in developing countries, such as those in South Asia and Southeast Asia. Now, head and neck squamous cell carcinoma is associated with the use of tobacco, including cigarette and cigar smoking, and oral tobacco use, such as chewing tobacco or snuff. Other risk factors include excessive alcohol use, poor dental hygiene, and impaired immune status. Some patients, however, develop oral head and neck cancer without any of these known risk factors. It can even occur in young adults. Head and neck squamous cell carcinoma is usually subdivided by anatomic region into the oral cavity or mouth, the oropharynx, including the tonsils and the back of the tongue or base of tongue, and the larynx or voice box, and the hypopharynx, the swallowing tube just above the esophagus. Over the last two decades, there has been a significant increase in the number of patients in the United States who develop squamous carcinomas of the oropharynx, particularly in the tonsils and the base of tongue. Many of these oropharynx cancers occur in non-smokers and are associated with HPV, or human papillomavirus. This is the same virus that is linked with cervical cancer. Now, treatment for patients with head and neck squamous cell carcinoma is much easier and much more successful when the cancers are detected early. Screening for oral cancer is often performed during routine dental checkups. In fact, there are some oral lesions, such as leukoplakia or erythroplakia, that can be identified during an oral examination. And the importance of these lesions is that they may indicate an increased risk of developing oral cancer. In many places around the United States, free oral and head and neck cancer screening programs are offered in April in conjunction with the OHANCA, or Oral Head and Neck Cancer Awareness Week program. The signs and symptoms of head and neck cancer will vary according to the location of a patient's tumor. In general, any sore, ulcer, or lump or mass in the mouth or oropharynx that does not heal or disappear within a few weeks should be checked by your dentist or doctor. Just because a sore does not hurt or bother you is not a good reason to ignore it and hope it will go away. In fact, most early cancers do not cause pain initially. Other symptoms of head and neck cancer include hoarseness and change of voice quality, persistent sore throat, difficulty swallowing, spitting or coughing up blood, and persistent ear pain. In some patients, however, the first sign of head and neck cancer is an enlarged lymph node in the neck, and this is due to the metastatic spread from an asymptomatic primary tumor. Any lymph node swelling in the neck that does not resolve with a round of antibiotics should be further evaluated by your doctor or other healthcare worker. A good place to go for more information about signs and symptoms of head and neck cancer is the oralcancerfoundation.org, and other online sites are also helpful. Head and neck cancer patients in general are best treated with a multidisciplinary team that includes head and neck surgeons, reconstructive or plastic surgeons, radiation oncologist, medical oncologist, speech pathologist, dental oncologist, prosthodontist, nutritionist, social workers, and many others. Usually the head and neck surgeon, whether trained as an otolaryngologist or ENT, oral maxillofacial surgeon, or general surgeon, is the first to examine and stage the patient with head and neck cancer. The patient should receive a complete head and neck physical examination. Up to 15% of patients who present with a head and neck cancer may also have a second site of cancer in the head and neck region, lung, or even esophagus. Often, the head and neck examination includes a flexible fiber optic endoscopy to better examine the larynx and pharynx. Usually, some type of X-ray imaging is also obtained, such as a CT, MRI, or CT PET scan, in order to better evaluate the deep extent of the tumor and look for the presence of enlarged or metastatic lymph nodes in the neck. A biopsy of the tumor is generally performed either in the clinic under local anesthesia or in the operating room under general anesthesia, depending, of course, on the location of the cancer. A biopsy refers to the removal of a small piece of tissue from the tumor so that it can be evaluated by a pathologist. The pathologist examines the tissue under the microscope to verify the presence of cancer and also to classify it based on the type of cell from which the cancer originated. As I mentioned earlier, most cancers involve the lining of the upper aerodigestive tract, including the mouth, the throat, and the voice box, are squamous cell carcinomas. In some patients, the only indication that there is a head and neck cancer is the presence of enlarged neck nodes. No ulcer, mass, sore, or other lesions is readily available or identified by physical examination. In this situation, the diagnosis of head and neck cancer is usually made by inserting a small needle into the enlarged lymph node to remove cells for the pathologist to examine. This procedure is called a fine needle aspiration, or FNA for short. Now, head and neck cancers, like most other cancers, are staged or classified according to the extent of the tumor. the AJCC, or the American Joint Commission on Cancer, staging system is the one most commonly used to define the extent of a patient's disease. In this system, referred to as the TNM system, T, which stands for tumor, is used to describe the extent of the primary cancer. N, which stands for node, is used to describe the extent of lymph nodal involvement of cancer. And M, which stands for metastases, is used to describe the presence of distant metastatic disease. Now, T1 is the smallest primary tumor size, whereas T4 is the largest. And 0 indicates no lymph node metastasis, whereas N3 describes the most extensive nodal disease. The patient's overall tumor stage, as defined by the AJCC, is determined by the overall TNM involvement of cancer. Now, further details on staging head and neck cancer can be found at several online sites, including www.entnet.org and www.cancerstaging.org. Patients with distant metastatic disease and plus disease, or cancer that has spread throughout the bloodstream to distant sites, are not usually curable by standard existing therapies. However, patients can enroll in clinical trials that are testing newly discovered anti-cancer drugs or obtain long periods of symptom control with more traditional chemotherapy regimens. Therapy of the head and neck cancers varies according to the anatomic subsite in which the primary tumor develops. I would like to reemphasize that because of the highly complex and functionally significant features of the head and neck region, it is really, really important that patients with head and neck cancer be managed by a multidisciplinary team of healthcare workers. Ideally, patients should be evaluated upfront by as many members of the team as possible so that they can all provide input on all decisions regarding treatment strategies. So on to the overview about treatment. Now, Drs. Posner and Rosenthal will provide more in-depth information about the roles of chemotherapy and radiation therapy in patients with head and neck cancer later on in this program. Now, cancers of the oral cavity or mouth are generally treated with surgery. Although radiation therapy alone can also be effective for some early oral cancers, the long-term side effects of radiation are generally worse than those from the surgery needed to remove small to intermediate-sized tumors. In advanced or aggressive cases of oral cancer, a combination of surgery and radiation are often required. Clinical trials are also evaluating the role of chemotherapy and newer targeted therapies in patients with oral cancer. Surgery for oral cancer involves removal of the cancerous lesion and also a surrounding cuff of normal tissue. The extent of the surgery is determined by the extent of the cancer. Treatment of some cancers also involves removal of the lymph nodes in the neck. Neck lymph nodes filter the tissue fluid that drains from the oral cavity, the oropharynx, and the larynx. Cancer cells can migrate into this tissue fluid and become trapped within the neck lymph nodes. Removal of the neck lymph nodes is accomplished by a neck dissection. Most intermediate or advanced cancers are treated with surgical resection of the primary tumor and also a neck dissection. Recently, clinical research studies have been evaluating the role of lymphoscintigraphy and lymphatic mapping to identify sentinel lymph nodes in oral cancer. In this procedure, a radioactive tracer is injected into the primary oral cancer, and nuclear medicine studies such as SPECT are used to identify the lymph node, which is the first or the sentinel site where drainage from the region of tumor is identified. Theoretically, if any metastasis from the primary tumor have spread to the lymph nodes, they will have spread first to the sentinel lymph node. Removal and pathologic analysis of the sentinel lymph node is used to determine whether or not any cancer nodal metastasis are present in the neck. The use of lymphoscintigraphy and lymphatic mapping is being evaluated to replace the more standard procedure of elective neck dissection for oral cancers. More aggressive cancers may require administration of post-op radiation therapy or even combinations of chemotherapy and radiation therapy. Some of the indications for post-op radiation include presence of closer involved margins of resection, perineal invasion, that is tracking of the cancer cells along nerves, vascular invasion, invasion of cancer cells into the lymphatic or blood vessels, metastatic spread of cancer to lymph nodes, usually more than one lymph node, or extracapsular invasion. That means extension of the cancer outside the lymph node into the fatty or other tissues of the neck. Now, smaller lesions require less removal of oral tissue and often heal very well with minimal impact on speech or swallowing. Larger lesions, especially those involving the bone of the mandible or a large area of the tongue, floor, mouth, or cheek, may require more extensive reconstructive surgery to provide optimal functional and cosmetic results. In those situations, often a reconstructive or plastic surgeon is called on to bring in tissue from an area outside of the head and neck into the surgical defect to provide optimal replacement of tissue that has been removed in order to resect the cancer. It is often necessary to perform a free flap to reconstruct these larger surgical defects. A free flap is when tissue is removed from a distant site, such as the leg or arm, with its own artery and veins, and then transferred to the surgical defect where the blood supply to the flap is reestablished by sewing the artery and vein into an appropriate blood vessel in the neck. For instance, often a bone from the leg, the fibula, is used to replace portions of the mandible or jawbone. A dentist or prosthodontist can even place dental implants in the jawbone to facilitate dental reconstruction in some cases. It is very important that patients with head and neck cancer are evaluated before, during, and after treatment by a speech pathologist in order to obtain optimal speech and swallowing function. And Dr. Lewin will discuss this in more detail later on in our program. Now we move on to discuss treatment of cancers of the oropharynx, including the tonsils, base of tongue, soft palate, and pharyngeal wall. Patients with oropharyngeal cancer are most commonly treated with radiation therapy or combined radiation and chemo. This therapeutic approach allows the best conservation of speech and swallowing function while maintaining excellent control of the cancer and high patient survival rates. Sometimes in patients with nodal disease in the neck, the enlarged lymph nodes do not completely disappear after radiation. And in those instances, the surgeon will need to remove the residual nodal disease, often with little or no functional deficits. However, patients who do not obtain complete response or complete disappearance of disease in the oropharynx do not fare well, unfortunately. Surgical salvage of primary oropharyngeal cancers after radiation or chemoradiation therapy has a lower rate of successful outcomes. In the last 5 to 10 years, there's been an increasing interest in a less invasive surgical approach to remove cancers of the oropharynx. In carefully selected patients with small to medium-sized primary oropharyngeal tumors, the laser or surgical robot can help surgeons remove the cancers through the mouth. Often, however, a separate procedure may be necessary to remove lymph nodes in the neck at risk to harbor cancer metastasis.
Thank you very much, Dr. Gilmore. This is really excellent, really, presentation, and you've covered, it's been so comprehensive in your presentation. A wonderful overview of the surgical approach to head and neck cancer, and I really appreciate that. And so thank you so much. It's an excellent, excellent presentation. Our next speaker is Dr. Marshall Posner. Dr. Posner is Medical Director, Head and Neck Medical Oncology, Professor of Medicine and Professor of Gene and Cell Medicine, the Tisch Cancer Institute, Mount Sinai School of Medicine. Dr. Posner is going to address new chemotherapy options, clinical trials, and pain and symptom management. Dr. Posner?
Thank you. And thank you for that great discussion, Dr. Gillenwater. First, I'd like to start by saying that the major change in head and neck cancer biology, which impacts on our decisions about treatment, has been the identification of that a large fraction of oropharynx cases have been caused by the human papillomavirus. This is important because those cancers in which HPV is the driver of the cancer formation or the carcinogenesis tend to have a much better prognosis and respond better to therapy than those cancers that are caused by more environmental carcinogens, and that includes smoking, tobacco products that are chewed, and alcohol. Identification of HPV in a tumor has major impact on the prognosis. It has not yet defined treatment for patients, and many clinical trials are now being developed to assess how to actually change the treatment for patients with oropharynx cancer caused by HPV. This would be a minor issue in head and neck cancer if it were not for the fact that the frequency of this particular kind of cancer has increased dramatically in the last 30 years, and that we now see almost 70 to 80% of oropharyngeal carcinomas being caused by HPV, and this number actually equals the number of environmental cancers that we're addressing. In fact, the rate of oropharynx cancer has surpassed the rate of cervical cancer, another HPV-caused disease in the United States, because of the ability to identify and diagnose cervical cancer in advance of it becoming aggressive and invasive. So what we have seen to date has been a number of trials that have been completed or that are ongoing to look at HPV patients with HPV oropharynx cancer. Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group recently completed a trial in which they gave chemotherapy followed by chemo radiotherapy using reduced doses of radiation to establish whether it was feasible to treat patients with less radiation therapy. It's very clear that radiation therapy for cure in these patients is one of the major causes of late side effects for patients. Patients who get radiation get dry mouths. They have scarring in the musculature. It becomes more difficult to swallow or to speak. And there are later effects on the vasculature, the big blood vessels in the neck that can affect patients, as well as the problems associated with the difficulty swallowing that leads to aspiration. So reducing radiation therapy for patients is one of the primary goals, I think, of several of the clinical trials that have been proposed. The Eastern Cooperative Oncology trial was a phase 2 trial. It's a very small trial, and it's completed, and we'll be interested in hearing the data on this trial. So patients with oropharynx cancer should have their cancer tested. Right now, we don't have any specific recommendations with regard to standard treatments, but there are a number of experimental therapies that might be available to them, and there are also studies we're looking at to establish who in that population of oropharynx cancers might best benefit from a reduction of therapy. The Radiation Therapy Oncology Group has a trial comparing radiation to a full dose with cisplatinum, that's chemo radiotherapy, to radiation with a full dose to Erbitux, a biologic that attacks something called the EGFR receptor that's expressed on these tumors. And Erbitux and cisplatinum have both been shown to improve survival in patients who receive chemotherapy and radiation compared to radiation alone. So this trial is available for patients. And it does allow a change in therapy, although there is no reduction in the radiation that's being provided. In addition to those trials, we are opening a trial in the New York region in the next 2 or 3 months, which will compare induction chemotherapy, similar to the ECOG study, with low-dose radiation versus standard-dose radiation and chemotherapy for patients with HPV-related cancer. These kinds of trials are designed to ask whether reduced radiation is feasible. The group in Pittsburgh, in cooperation with the Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group, is proposing a trial, which we hope will open also shortly, looking at reduced radiation in patients undergoing surgical resection. As Dr. Gillenwater has aptly pointed out, there's some new technology in surgery which improves the ability to perform surgery in this area with less tissue damage, with less bystander damage to other normal structures. And so patients can come out of surgery much more functionally intact, capable of eating, drinking, and swallowing normally, and they recover from surgery within a few days as opposed to several weeks to months in patients who had extensive surgical procedures in the past that required more tissue invasion to be able to perform. So the laser microdissection surgery and the transoral robotic surgery have allowed us to perform operations on intermediate and low stage tonsil and oropharynx cancer patients with very good clinical outcomes. And the ECOG trial, which I referred to earlier, as well as trials that will be ongoing at Mount Sinai, at Washington University, and other centers, will investigate whether patients who've had a complete resection with good prognostic features can get by without any radiation therapy or chemoradiotherapy at all. And those patients with poor prognostic features may be investigated in some of these trials for less and the chemotherapy and radiation postoperatively. So there are attempts in this group of patients to reduce the toxicity. Currently, for patients with environmentally caused cancers, smoking and drinking-related tumors, and I want to emphasize that you can have smoked in the past and can have had some alcohol intake and still have an HPV-related cancer. It's simply that the HPV-related cancers occur frequently in patients who don't smoke and drink, those patients would not ordinarily have gotten these cancers. So even though somebody has a history of smoking, they may still have an HPV-related cancer. So there are a number of efforts designed to identify new drugs that might be used in this population in adjuvant therapy. There's a large trial being performed with tyrosine kinase inhibitor known as afatinib, in which patients who have completed a course of chemoradiotherapy can then take 18 months of this oral agent as an adjuvant. This is an attempt to reduce the rate of local regional recurrence, which is the major form of a recurrence of disease for patients, and this trial is opening shortly. And this drug is very promising, and it has a very good response rate. There are no other agents that have been shown to be effective as an adjuvant after chemoradiotherapy for patients, and this is one trial that will look at this. There is a trial that was completed recently using another tyrosine kinase inhibitor of a similar type, labatinib, which GSK has recently completed, and the data from this trial will not be available for several years. Finally, there are a whole host of new agents available for patients who have recurrent and metastatic disease that identify and treat new targets within certain pathways that are changed in cancer patients. A pathway known as the PI3 kinase pathway has been shown to be abnormal in patients with head and neck cancer, and there are a number of PI3 kinase inhibitors by Novartis. BKM-120 is going into clinical trials soon, and several others by some of the other drug companies. None of these are currently available in large trials for patients. You have to search for these in individual locations at the moment. There are trials for other tyrosine kinase inhibitors, including one known as c-MET, and there are a number of agents produced by different companies that will be useful in potentially these diseases and are going to be studied shortly. I'd also like to mention that there are a host of attempts to look at immune modulation in patients, and there are trials engaging the use of ipilimumab, a Bristol-Myers product that enhances immune responses, and there will be trials looking at this in head and neck cancer caused by HPV and EBV. And finally, I just want to mention that there are several virolytic trials out there, trials that look at viruses in conjunction with chemotherapy. A company has produced a agent in BioVex. This agent is directly injected into the tumors and has had some activity in melanoma and in conjunction with radiation therapy. There's also a trial for recurrent disease using a virus known as reovirus, which attacks tumor cells that are that have a particular molecular change. They have overactivity of something called the RAS pathway, and this trial is available also as a phase 3 trial for patients who have recurrent and metastatic disease. So there are a whole host of clinical trials, and I would say that the approval recently of Erbitux with platinum and 5-FU really opens the ability of patients with recurrent metastatic disease to really get the most optimal chemotherapy using this particular combination. So I think what we're going to see in the next several years is a distinct pathway for patients based on whether they have HPV positive or HPV negative head and neck cancer. The availability of new vaccines and screening tools that will be helpful for us to identify people at risk and also to prevent the recurrence or the occurrence of this disease. Several vaccines will be available, I'm sure, in the next 3 to 4 years in study as therapeutics, that is, therapeutic vaccines. I think we'll see some of these new agents available for patients with the more traditional environmentally related cancers caused by smoking, alcohol, and also by environmental carcinogens such as diesel fumes or smoke from wood fires, all of which contribute to the development of head and neck cancer. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Posner, for an excellent presentation, very comprehensive and informative for everybody on the call, with also really discussing clinical trial information as well. So thank you so much. Our next speaker is Dr. David Rosenthal. Dr. Rosenthal is professor, section chief, head and neck radiation oncology, Department of Radiation Oncology, University of Texas, MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Rosenthal is going to address concurrent chemotherapy and radiotherapy and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Rosenthal.
Thank you, Carolyn, and for Cancer Care for inviting me to participate in this conference. I've enjoyed doing these, and I know that many patients find it very helpful to gather new insights about cancer treatment. I want to talk to you today about chemoradiation, concurrent chemoradiation for head and neck cancer, mostly in the context of clinical trial and multidisciplinary team involvement, and also some very important comments about communication with the healthcare team, mostly about symptoms and how we want to foster patients feeling open to communicate about their concerns or side effects from their cancer or cancer treatment so that they could be made more comfortable and not suffer from those symptoms or even worry about them. Our goal in treating patients with head and neck cancer is to give the best chances for cure with the best function. We are now fortunate in having several modalities to do this. We have surgery, radiation therapy, and chemotherapy. The first comment I want to make about this is that these different modalities are not competitive. They're complementary. Each modality has its own benefit and limitation. It's just as if we were building a house, if we want to put in a screw, we would use a screwdriver. If we want to put in a nail, we would use a hammer. Similarly, surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy each play roles that complement each other that allow us to put together a construction project to give the best outcomes. Now, our goal, again, is not only to give the best chances for curing the cancer, but with the best function. What we've learned is that side effects from the cancer and also potential side effects from treatment can cause not only unpleasant symptoms that the patient will suffer from their cancer and treatment in that time frame, but after they recover, it might alter some of the functions. This can be cosmetic appearance. It could be ability to eat, chew, swallow, speak naturally. And that is our goal, is to preserve the function. So when we talk about organ preservation, what our real concern is to preserve a functional organ so that patients can have the best quality of functional life as possible. Now, how do we approach this? We do this by trying to personalize cancer care. What does that mean? There are two main approaches to this. One is to tailor these traditional treatments, surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy, so that we make the right choice for the right patient. We accomplish this by the involvement of the multidisciplinary cancer team. And what I mean by this is that up front, before treatment is started, patients are all in our institution and most large tertiary care cancer centers are seen by the surgeon, the radiation oncologist, and the medical oncologist. And then we meet together in conference with our radiologists, with our dental oncologists, speech pathologists, dietitians, the other parts of the cancer team, so that we can put together the best package that's going to come to that goal of giving the best cancer control with the fewest side effects and the best function. Another thing that we mean by personalized cancer care is when we can test genetic information about a patient's tumor or response information about testing that's done in the laboratory, or look at a new development agent that is a new drug that's not FDA approved yet in the context of a clinical trial, and in this targeted agent may have a mechanism of action that is specific for attacking an abnormal function within a tumor cell that doesn't exist in a normal cell, and then hopefully giving a nice differential result in having a good effect on killing those bad cancer cells while not harming or having minimal side effects on the normal cells. These advances are made in the context of clinical trials. These are formal trials that are reviewed by scientific councils and institutional review boards to verify the safety, the solidity of the context and the data behind it before they're taken to patients. These can be done at institutions singly or nationally. This is how we can bring cutting-edge advances to individual patients. The treatments that are offered to patients now have been developed in clinical trials in the past, and this is how we make incremental advances by continuing along with these. So I encourage all of you to speak to your doctors about clinical trial involvement and what all of the options are available. I want to make a specific comment about one of my main areas of discussion today is concurrent chemoradiation. Chemotherapy can be given either before, during, or after radiation therapy. When we give it after radiation therapy, it's called adjuvant chemotherapy, and that hasn't been found to be as helpful. Most of the focus has been on chemotherapy at the same time with radiation therapy, and this is called concurrent chemoradiation or concomitant chemoradiation, or when the chemotherapy is given before the radiation treatment. And this is called induction or neoadjuvant chemotherapy, of which Dr. Posner is speaking on and who is really a world expert in this area. Now, with respect to concurrent chemoradiation, there have been more than a dozen prospective randomized controlled phase 3 trials. And what I mean by phase 3 is that, say, half of the patients would get radiation therapy alone, and the other half would get radiation therapy with the addition of one of these chemotherapy or targeted agent drugs that has the specific mechanism of action of interest. And then we would compare the outcomes. And we now have more than a dozen of these trials that show that concurrent chemo radiation can improve local control and survival for appropriately selected patients very significantly. And this has become now standard of care. We're further developing this in new trials with new drugs and new combinations. Some of the, we've looked at prognostic factors in tumors, such as the epidermoid growth factor receptor and agents that are directed towards that. The human papillomavirus is now an important prognostic factor that is being evaluated in clinical trials. And then there are patient factors, such as anemia, that have been found to be important. So again, to summarize this this section, there are very thoughtful physicians at different institutions who look at some of the prognostic factors in the tumors and in the patients and look at the new agents that are available to put in combination to try to enhance the effect of radiation so that when we add this new agent to radiation treatment, our goal is to improve local control and survival with the fewest toxicities. In summary, I want to say that our goal for most patients is to cure their cancers. The vast majority of patients with head and neck cancer are treated curatively. Second, it's important to realize that functional organ preservation is a reality for most patients. Next, the gains that we've seen in improved survival and improved functionality have come through clinical trials. And again, I encourage you to speak to your physicians about this. And finally, I want to mention that cancers and cancer treatments, we all know, have side effects. Your healthcare team is very concerned about your symptoms. We want to know your symptoms. We want to treat them. The reason for this is because you will feel better. And we've also found that there are better outcomes to cancer treatment when patients are more comfortable. There's no benefit to stoicism or silent suffering. Some patients might think, well, I've got cancer, I'm getting cancer treatment, I'm supposed to have symptoms. Well, there are side effects, but what we want to do is to minimize those. So my main message about this is do not wait until your next appointment with the physician. If you have a prominent bothersome symptom, please communicate with your healthcare team about these. And finally, I want to mention that we work together with the main treatment modalities, surgery, radiation, chemotherapy, to put together treatment packages for patients. And then we work together with some of the other specialties involved on the multidisciplinary cancer team, such as dental oncology, speech-language pathology, dietitians, and there are other services that are involved. And everybody on the team is important to optimize a package for each individual patient to give the best cancer control with the fewest symptoms and the best outcomes. Carolyn, I want to thank you for inviting me to speak with you today.
Thank you very much, Dr. Rosenthal. It was a really superb, really presentation and very, very informative, but also very compassionate and just excellent points that you made. And I thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Jan Lewin. And Dr. Lewin is professor, Department of Head and Neck Surgery, Section Chief, Speech Pathology and Audiology, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Lewin is going to address speech and swallowing rehabilitation. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Lewin.
Thank you, Carolyn. Dr. Gillenwater has just reviewed the options for treatment and their effects, and it's no surprise that speech and swallowing dysfunction are frequent consequences of head and neck cancer and its treatment. We know that more than 75% of patients treated for cancers of the vocal folds will experience changes in their voice. And we also know that at least 50% of head and neck cancer survivors have swallowing dysfunction and may not even realize it because the cancer treatment has affected their ability to sense the problem. We have certainly learned that the ability to preserve the organ does not always ensure that the organ will function and that patient outcomes will vary both in terms of the cancer treatment response as well as the response to rehabilitation or restoration. It is important to understand that the larynx and the pharynx engage in multiple functions that require extensive neural control, almost like a functional time-sharing that has to ensure respiration, phonation, and deglutition while avoiding adverse events such as aspiration. Evaluation is critical. Simply observing swallowing does not tell us anything about the physiology of the disorder, nor does it allow us to determine the etiology or cause of the problem, which in turn prevents us from establishing effective treatment to resolve the problem. Thus, treatment for swallowing disorders that is based on inaccurate identification of swallowing physiology is not only ineffective, but it's useless. It's also important to realize that patients' reports of speech and swallowing abilities are often unreliable. In other words, perception doesn't always equate with actual ability. Sometimes patients will report normal swallowing when, in fact, an examination reveals abnormal swallowing function. Alternatively, patients with radiation-induced xerostomia, or dryness of the mouth, frequently report abnormal swallowing when, in fact, their ability to swallow is quite normal. Data from the past 10 to 15 years has clearly shown that surgery or radiation therapy, with or without the addition of chemotherapy, will result in specific and sometimes different kinds of swallowing problems depending on the site of the tumor, the extent of the surgery, and the type of reconstruction. In general, patients who are treated surgically experience functional disabilities that are usually proportional to the volume of the resection. Following oral cavity resections, data show that preservation of the anterior tongue will be critical for speech production, but the tongue base remains the most essential lingual region for normal swallowing. Even after surgery that totally removes the oral tongue, a patient can learn to swallow safely as long as the base of tongue is preserved and continues to function. Findings also show that 98% of the speech produced by treated patients with advanced oral cancers will be intelligible even when the surgery includes the tongue. When reconstruction is needed, research has found that flaps that fill the surgical defect produce better ability to swallow and speak than bulky ones that overfill the space. Essentially, the degree of functional impairment often depends on the quality rather than the extent of the reconstruction. New data show that laser surgeries, especially laser resections of small tumors, may have better functional outcomes than traditional surgeries, as well as radiation therapy. After laser surgery, patients generally have shorter hospital stays and experience faster medical recovery. In select cases, radiation therapy can actually be avoided. Patients frequently regain swallowing ability faster without the severe side effects caused by the radiation. We are still investigating the benefit of radiation therapy and its effect on speech and swallowing in patients who are treated with laser surgeries. However, not all patients are candidates for laser surgery. Research has shown that knowing baseline speech and swallowing abilities helps to predict post-treatment outcomes. Therefore, treatment selection should depend on evidence-based information to help patients select the right alternative to treat their cancer, while at the same time preserve the ability to speak and swallow after treatment. Alternatively, the effects of radiation therapy will produce immediate as well as long-term changes in speech, voice, and swallowing that may increase in severity years after the completion of the radiation. In general, radiation has a greater effect on swallowing than it does on speech. Patients who have swallowing problems before treatment are at higher risk for chronic swallowing disability after treatment, and they are also at a higher risk for permanent feeding tube dependence. The addition of chemotherapy can make these problems worse because chemotherapy accentuates the effects of the radiation. It's important to remember that early swallowing recovery from radiation therapy may in fact be misleading because of the delayed scarring or fibrosis, along with the occurrence of neuropathies that cause long-term swallowing deterioration. Late swallowing dysfunction and aspiration have been reported in up to 60% of patients treated with radiation therapy, and up to 70% of patients who aspirate do so silently without coughing or clearing their throat. Between 15 and 30% of patients who aspirate will require a feeding tube for nutrition. Research experience, however, shows that delaying the placement of a feeding tube until it is needed may in fact help preserve long-term swallowing function. Our data and that of other investigators has shown that regardless of the presence of a feeding tube, it is essential to continue to swallow whatever you can, even if it is just your own saliva. Patients who do not take anything by mouth for longer than 2 weeks often experience worse long-term swallowing deterioration. Therefore, it is important that patients who receive radiation therapy continue to swallow throughout the course of radiation therapy to help ensure long-term swallowing ability. Recently, targeted molecular therapies or biologic treatments in combination with radiation are being used to pinpoint specific genetic alterations in the tumor itself and spare normal tissue cells from damage. Again, early data suggests that acute mucosal toxicity and swallowing outcomes are not worsened by the addition of targeted molecular drugs to radiation. It is also important to know that a late onset of swallowing problems that occurs more than 1 year after the completion of radiation may not be a long-term effect of the radiation treatment. Rather, it may be an indication of recurrent disease. Therefore, it's important that patients who experience late-occurring swallowing problems be properly evaluated by a physician to rule out the presence of a new cancer. New research has defined specific swallowing exercises that target the muscle groups that will likely be impaired after head and neck cancer treatment. Recent data support the use of these preventative swallowing exercises that start early, before the cancer treatment begins. There are no pills, no medications, and in most cases, no surgeries that will fix swallowing problems once they have occurred. Findings show that patients who perform swallowing exercises before, during, and after treatment have a better swallowing-related quality of life, maintain adequate muscle tone and physiology, and are less dependent on feeding tubes both during and after treatment. Patients, therefore, should ask for swallowing exercises before radiation therapy begins and continue to do them throughout their treatment as much as possible. It is also just as important that patients ask questions about recommended swallowing therapy as it is to ask questions about their cancer treatment. Electrical or surface stimulation placed against the neck to induce muscle movement is frequently being used to improve swallowing in patients treated for head and neck cancer. Despite its therapeutic popularity, data from the National Institutes of Health suggest that electrical or surface stimulation may actually make swallowing function worse in some patients. Therefore, it is very, very important that the appropriateness of this type of therapy, electrical or surface stimulation, or any other swallowing therapy for that matter, be properly evaluated and its efficacy confirmed before it is used. In conclusion, clinical and research experience show that in many cases, long-term speech and swallowing dysfunction can be avoided. Despite the research and the clinical evidence, many patients with oral and head and neck cancer are still not referred for speech and swallowing evaluation. Thus, they do not receive the essential therapy to prevent long-term problems. Early concentrated intervention is absolutely critical. We at MD Anderson Cancer Center are partnering with colleagues to develop a predictive model for the prevention of speech and swallowing dysfunction, with, of course, the ultimate goal to identify at-risk patients to avoid long-term functional deterioration after treatment for head and neck cancer. And with that, I'll conclude and say again, Carolyn, it's been a pleasure, and thank you for the opportunity to participate in these terrific conferences.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Liu, and just an outstanding presentation, as always, just really extraordinary, and I can't thank you enough for your speaking on this program. Our next speaker is Dr. Douglas Peterson. Dr. Peterson is Professor of Oral Medicine, Chair, Program in Head and Neck Cancer and Oral Oncology, NAE Comprehensive Cancer Center, University of Connecticut Health Center. And Dr. Peterson is going to address guidelines for dental care during and after treatment and the importance of early detection and screening. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Peterson.
Thank you very much, Carolyn. I certainly appreciate the opportunity to contribute. In the next few minutes, I'd like to discuss some of the very important and highly successful dental approaches that can be utilized in relation to the treatment of oral and head and neck cancer. And the goal of these types of dental intervention is to prevent or at least minimize any problems with the patient's mouth during and in the many years after cancer treatment. Now, much of the decision-making relative to dental management is related to the decision-making for the cancer treatment, which is in turn based on the staging and location of the cancer, as we've already heard. And this links to one of the many reasons why screening for oral cancer and early detection and treatment of oral cancer are so important. The earlier the diagnosis is made, the sooner the oncology team can begin treatment that is customized to maximize the cure and minimize any side effects, including those side effects in the mouth. Now, it is important, I believe, to establish a few definitions because sometimes the words become a little confusing. We think in terms of dental in relation to teeth. The mouth actually, of course, includes the teeth, but also the gums and the lining tissues of the mouth, or mucosa, as well as the salivary glands. All of these mouth structures can be affected by head and neck cancer treatment. And these changes can be either temporary or sometimes permanent in the mouth, particularly in relation to the head and neck radiation. And so we've heard a few times today, very appropriately so, that given the complexity of the types of complications that can occur because of cancer treatment, including in the mouth, it's very, very important to have comprehensive management by the healthcare team that can often lead to prevention or at least minimizing many of these mouth complications. Now, some of these complications occur only in association with the treatment itself and then clear up a few weeks after the cancer treatment ends. And a very good example of this is sore mouth, or as it is technically known, mucositis. Other complications of the head and neck and mouth may persist for many years after the cancer treatment ends. For example, the dry mouth that we just heard about in relation to head and neck radiation, or the risk for a complication that's named osteoradionecrosis, in which the radiation to the jaw, particularly the lower jaw, permanently reduces the ability of the blood supply to feed the jawbones to help it fight off infection. So the radiation can cause this compromise in blood supply, particularly in the lower jaw, that can lead to problems years later unless the team works together before, during, and on a regular basis after the radiation ends. Now, the good news is that the mouth sores I just talked about can be managed very effectively in general, and that the risk for dry mouth or osteoradionecrosis can sometimes and oftentimes be prevented altogether or at least minimized by working with the healthcare team before and during and after the cancer treatment. So, for example, we heard some very cogent comments from Dr. Posner related to pain and management during some of the treatment for cancer. And I'd like to emphasize that in addition to some of the very sophisticated drug technologies that are becoming available, there are also some very basic approaches such as non-medicated mouth rinses, salt and water solutions to help keep the tissues clean, pain medications that can be either applied directly to the sore area in the mouth or given as a pill or by injection, and then medicines to help prevent or fight the infection. And again, as health professionals, we're constantly working with each of the patients to make sure that if an infection occurs, it's promptly treated and quickly eliminated. Dry mouth that we heard about can cause difficulties in taste, chewing, swallowing, and speaking, and it can also increase the risk for infection, for example, tooth infections or gum infections, which can in turn contribute to osteoradionecrosis over the years. So it becomes very important to have an approach that includes keeping the mouth moist if the mouth is dry, just using water or sugarless drinks often, avoiding drinks with caffeine, such as coffee or tea, since caffeine can dry the mouth. Don't use tobacco alcohol, because these can dry out the mouth. And then avoiding spicy or salty foods. Now, we'll hear more information in just a moment from Ms. Denise Anderson on the nutritional piece. I'd also like to emphasize that when the cancer treatment is finished and the patient's back home, the role of the healthcare team certainly doesn't stop. And the dentist can work with you and your needs relative to making sure that the teeth and gums are clean, the use of fluorides that are applied at home and in the dental office, and making sure that there is a diet that is low in sugar content, again, to reduce the risk of any dental cavities, dental infections, and potential serious complications. So in summary, before I turn this back to Carolyn, I'd just like to emphasize that there are excellent approaches that the dental team can help incorporate into the rest of your cancer treatment, working in very close collaboration with the oncology team as a whole. And as Dr. Rosenthal mentioned, it's very important to discuss these issues with the cancer team to make sure all of your questions and concerns are addressed. And this communication can lead to very positive outcomes, both during the cancer treatment as well as for many years thereafter. So I'll turn the podium back to Carolyn, and I again appreciate the opportunity to contribute.
Thank you very much, Dr. Peterson, and thank you for covering the very important issues of really just care of the mouth during treatment and after treatment. So excellent, really, very helpful to people. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Ms. Denise Anderson. Ms. Anderson is Senior Clinical Dietitian, Department of Clinical Nutrition, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, and she's going to address nutritional concerns and tips. Ms. Anderson?
Hi, Carolyn. Thank you so much, and I've always enjoyed doing these conferences with y'all. I learned so much listening to the other speakers at the same time. I want us to start by saying that most treatments for head and neck cancer, have it be from surgery, radiation, or chemotherapy, can affect your eating. These treatments will increase your need for nutrition, may require diet texture modifications, and you may need nutrition support in the form of a feeding tube to meet your nutritional goals. Eating well during your treatment can lower your fatigue level by giving you energy and keeping your strength up, while as well as maintaining your weight. Patients that maintain their weight with nutrition tend to tolerate treatments better and have a fast recovery from the side effects. To help you meet your nutritional goals, it is best to ask your doctor to see if you can meet with a dietitian so that they can go over your calorie needs, your protein needs, your fluid needs, and any other information that is nutritionally related to their side effects. Weight loss is the most common side effect during head and neck cancer treatments. This is mainly related to a decrease in food intake and also increased difficulty in chewing, swallowing, and oral cavity pain. Excessive weight loss can cause treatment delays, breaks in treatment, and a slow in the healing process. The main nutritional goal during your treatment is to maintain your weight and preserve lean muscle mass. This goal can be achieved by meeting the calories, proteins, and fluid needs that were provided by your dietitian. Remember that during cancer treatments, these needs may increase. The diet during treatment tends to be a high-calorie, high-protein diet to help patients meet their needs due to the reduced size of their meals. Keeping a daily food record of your intake can be very helpful. It will also make you aware of how much and how often you are eating. There are several calorie counters that are available on the Internet to help you with this. During treatments, diet modifications may be necessary due to difficulty swallowing and pain when eating. Patients may already be modifying their diets prior to any treatments. An example of a diet modification is that if you are eating a regular diet, this can change to a soft diet, then decrease to a chopped diet, decrease further to a pureed, blenderized diet, and then a liquid diet. You may have to supplement your diet during these changes with smoothies and shakes. A protein powder may be helpful to ensure your adequate protein intake. There are also liquid nutritional supplements that are over-the-counter that can be used as well. There are so many different kinds on the market, it is best to check with your healthcare provider to see what they recommend you use. If you cannot contain your weight loss, nutritional goals can be met through a feeding tube. Feeding tubes can be placed at any time during treatments. Patients who are underweight or who have lost a large amount of weight prior to treatments may want to consider having a feeding tube placed prior to starting. For others, if you start losing weight and cannot control your weight and you continue to have decreased intake, placement can be considered at that time. Feeding tubes should not be considered long-term. The length of time you may have a feeding tube is different for everyone, and it depends how nutritionally depleted you become. Feeding tubes can be used to help you achieve your nutritional goals and help with healing after you've completed treatment. Once the feeding tube is placed, it can become your primary source. However, it doesn't have to be your only source. As Dr. Lewin stressed earlier, we really encourage you to continue eating as much as you possibly can to preserve that swallow function. In preserving that swallow function, also, it helps you with weaning off that feeding tube later on after treatment. After cancer treatments, nutrition continues to be important. You will want to continue to meet your nutritional needs to ensure adequate healing. If you had a feeding tube placed, you will need to work with your dietitian to help you decrease the use of your feeding tube and resume a normal diet. Long-term side effects that may affect your food intake after treatment is taste changes, no taste, and dry mouth. I want you to continue to try different foods to help identify the foods that you may be able to taste. Taste may improve over time and with healing. Remember that foods that you did not like prior to treatments you may like now since you've had a taste change. To help with dry mouth, you want to eat foods that are moist and avoid foods that have a lot of bread and breading on them. Using gravies and sauces can help with eating during this time. However, it is not healthy over a long time. Try to match your flavors that you're eating at the time. For an example, if you're eating chicken, try chicken broth to add moisture to it instead of a gravy. When starting to eat again, your diet may not be as varied as it was prior to treatment. Taking a multivitamin may help complete your diet. You only need a vitamin that meets 100% of your daily needs. Remember that the American diet is highly fortified, and you may be eating enough foods that have added vitamins. As a final point, remember that your main goal is to maintain your weight and lean muscle mass during your treatment course. If you lost a lot of weight during treatment and are still at your ideal body weight or above, you do not need to regain to your previous weight. Check with your healthcare team to determine if your weight is appropriate at this time. Remember, you may be able to eat your way back into weight gain, but you cannot eat your way back into muscle gain. You will have to rebuild your muscle. Eating may never be the same as before, but as long as you get the foods in that you need and a healthy diet, you will be fine. Carolyn, I'll turn this back over to you. Thank you again.
Well, thank you very much, Denise, for just a wonderful presentation and very informative, with lots of tips for people in terms of how to handle different needs for food intake. So thank you so much. And I want to thank all of our speakers. They've really been quite outstanding. This has been a remarkable program, a lot of speakers and a lot of content covered today. It's a program that you may want to listen to again, actually, because there's just so much to take in, really. I also want to thank all of you who've been listening, and I want to remind all of you that this is a one-hour education workshop, and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. So please do contact the Cancer Care staff here. We have a staff of 45 master's-level trained oncology social workers, and we're here to provide a host of services, from a practical and financial assistance to counseling support, whether it be individually or in groups, and telephone and online groups as well. And we welcome you to participate in our education workshops like this one, and also to make use of any of our fact sheets and our booklets as well. Most importantly, as we conclude today, I don't want anyone to feel that you're alone. I want you to now know that you're part of a community of support, and we're here to help you. We're simply a telephone call away, 1-800-813-HOPE, or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. Thank you all. Have a great day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.